Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia items. So, if you're hearing this, I must be away this week. This is my extra program. Consequently, we do not have the regular musical trivia questions and answer, nor do we have any transitions for today's program. Instead, we will open and close today's program with a few odd and fun facts about music gathered from the website skyminds.net. For example, number one here is the only guy in the band ZZ Top who doesn't have a beard is Frank Beard. And the first CD that was pressed in the U.S. was Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. And finally, in 1976, Barry Manilow sang a chart-topping song named I Write the Songs. The song wasn't written by him.
Hey, good looking.
Oh.
We begin today's special program with this country music profile. From biography.com, Hank Williams, songwriter, singer, 1923 to 1953. Hank Williams became one of America's first country music superstars with hits like Your Cheatin' Heart before his early death at 29. Quotes, I was a pretty good imitator of Roy Acuff, but then I found out they already had a Roy Acuff. So I started singing like myself. And this is Hank Williams performing Hey Good Lookin' in the background right now.
I'm free, I'm ready, so we can go steady. So how's about saving all your time for me?
Hank Williams was born September the 17th, 1923, in Mount Olive, Alabama. Considered one of the most popular American country music singer-songwriters with songs like Cold, Cold Heart, Your Cheatin' Heart, Hey Good Lookin', and I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. He died of a heart attack at the age of 29 in 1953 in the backseat of his Cadillac. Widely considered country music's first superstar, Hiram, Hank, Williams, was born September 17, 1923, in Mount Olive, Alabama. Cut from rural stock, Williams, the third child of Lon and Lily Williams, grew up in a household that never had much money. His father worked as a logger before entering the Veterans Administration's hospital when young Hank was just six. Frank and son rarely saw each other over the next decade, with Williams's mother, who ran rooming houses, moving the family to Greenville and later Montgomery, Alabama. His childhood was also shaped by his spinal condition, spina bifida, which set him apart from other kids his age and fostered a sense of separateness from the world around him. The world he seemed to identify most with was the musical sounds that poured out of the radio and emanated from church choirs. A quick study, Williams learned how to play folk, country, and from an African-American street musician named Rufus Payne, the blues. By the time he moved with his mother to Montgomery in 1937, Williams's music career was already in motion. Picking up the guitar for the first time at the age of eight, Williams was just 13 when he made his radio debut. A year later, he was entering talent shows and had his own band, Hank Williams and his Drifting Cowboys. In full support of Williams's musical aspirations was his mother, Lily. She drove her son and his band to shows throughout southern Alabama. By the early 1940s, he'd caught the attention of music executives in Nashville. But coupled with Williams' obvious talents as a singer and songwriter was an increasing dependence on alcohol, which he'd started abusing in order to relieve his sometimes excruciating back pain. As a result, he was not considered a reliable performer. Williams' personal life took a major turn in 1943 when he met Audrey Mae Shepherd, who was the mother of a young daughter and had only recently left a messy marriage. Under Williams' guidance, Shepherd started playing bass and began performing in his band. Williams and Shepherd married in 1944. In 1949, they had a son together, Hank Williams Jr., on May the 26th, 1949. In 1946, Williams traveled to Nashville to meet his music publisher, Fred Rose, and the Acuff Rose Publications Company. What began with Williams writing material for singer Molly O'Day eventually gave way to a record contract with the recently created MGM label. A year after first meeting with Rose, Williams had his first hit, Move It On Over. In April 1948, he scored a second Billboard success with Honky Tonkin', but along with his early success came increased erratic behavior from Williams, who often showed up at live performances drunk. For a time, his relationship with Fred Rose deteriorated, but the two were able to mend fences, paving the way for Williams to become a regular on the Louisiana Hayride, a regular Saturday night performance hosted by a radio station in Shreveport, Louisiana. The performances greatly increased Williams' name recognition, but he still lacked a number one hit. That all changed in 1949 with the release of Lovesick Blues, a throwaway rendition of an old show tune he'd pushed to tape at the end of a recording session. The song resonated with music fans as well as executives at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, who invited Williams to perform. In ways that must have seemed unimaginable to this poor country boy, Williams's life quickly changed. His stardom put money in his pocket and gave him the kind of creative freedom artists long for. Over the next several years, he churned out a number of other big hits, including Cold, Cold Heart, Your Cheatin' Heart, Hey, Good Lookin', Lost Highway, and I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. He also wrote a number of religious songs under the pseudonym Luke the Drifter. As the titles of some of Williams' songs suggest, heartbreak and turmoil were never that far from his life. As his success deepened, so did Williams's dependence on alcohol and morphine. The Opry eventually fired him, and in 1952, he and Shepherd divorced. His physical appearance diminished too. His hair began falling out, and he put on 30 extra pounds. In late 1951, he suffered a minor heart attack while visiting his sister in Florida. On New Year's Day, 1953, he took his seat in the back of his 1952 powder blue Cadillac as his driver, college student Charles Carr, barreled toward a concert venue in Canton, Ohio. Williams's health took a turn for the worst. Finally, after not hearing from the singer for 2 solid hours, the driver pulled the car over in Oak Hill, West Virginia, at 5:30 in the morning. Williams was pronounced dead a short while later. His passing did not bring about the end of his stardom. However, it could be argued, in fact, that his early death only enhanced his legend. If Williams had lived, it's not entirely certain that the Nashville music community, so eager to shed its hillbilly roots, would have continued to embrace Williams' music. In the years since his death, Williams' impact has only grown, with artists as varied as Perry Como, Diana Washington, Nora Jones, and Bob Dylan, all covering his work. Today, Hank Williams is a member of the Country Music Hall of Fame, and in 2010, the Pulitzer Board awarded Williams a special citation for songwriting. Thank you. Next up is this classical music profile, biography.com. Frédéric Chopin, pianist, composer, 1810 to 1849. Considered Poland's greatest composer, Frédéric Chopin focused his efforts on piano composition and was a strong influence on composers who followed him. Synopsis? Born on March the 1st, 1810, in Poland, Frédéric Chopin grew up in a middle-class family. He published his first composition at age 7, began performing 1 year later. In 1832, he moved to Paris, socialized with high society, and was known as an excellent piano teacher. His piano compositions were highly influential. He died on April the 17th, 1849, in Paris, France. And this is Chopin's Polonaise Brillante playing in the background right now. Frédéric Chopin was born Frédéric Franciszek Chopin, and that's spelled S-Z-O-P-E-N, that last name, by the way, on March the 1st, 1810, in a small village in Duchy of Warsaw, now Poland. His father, Nicholas, was a French émigré who was working as a bookkeeper when he married. Soon after Frédéric was born, Nicholas found employment as a tutor for aristocratic families in Warsaw. His father's employment exposed young Chopin to cultured Warsaw society, and his mother introduced him to music at an early age. By age 6, young Chopin was ably playing the piano and composing tunes. Recognizing his talent, his family engaged a professional musician for lessons, and soon pupil surpassed teacher in both technique and imagination. By 1818, Chopin was performing in elegant salons and writing his own compositions, including the Polonaise in G minor. By 1826, he had composed several piano pieces in different styles, and his parents enrolled him in the Warsaw Conservatory of Music, where he studied for 3 years under Polish composer Józef Eisner. However, sensing he needed a broader musical experience, Chopin's parents eventually sent him to Vienna, where he made his performance debut in 1829. Audiences were enthralled by his highly technical yet poetically expressive performances. Over the next few years, Chopin performed in Poland, Germany, Austria, and Paris, where he settled in 1832. There, he quickly established relationships with other young composers, among them Franz Liszt, Vincenzo Bellini, and Felix Mendelssohn. While in Paris, Chopin found his delicate style didn't always enthrall the larger concert audiences who had been exposed to the works of Franz Schubert and Ludwig van Beethoven. A fortuitous introduction to the Rothschild family opened new doors, however, and Chopin soon found employment in the great parlors of Paris as both recitalist and teacher. His increased income allowed him to live well and compose nocturnes, the Scherzo in B-flat minor, and the Sonata in B-flat minor. Though Chopin had had youthful love affairs and was at one time engaged, none of his relationships lasted more than a year. In 1838, he began a love affair with French novelist Armantine Dupin, a.k.a. George Sand. The couple spent a harsh winter on the island of Majorca, south of France, where Chopin became ill. In March 1839, Sand realized that Chopin needed medical attention and took him to Marseille, where he was diagnosed with consumption, tuberculosis. After a period of recuperation in Marseille, in May 1839, Chopin and Sand settled south of Paris in Nohant, Sand's country home. The next 7 years proved to be the happiest and most productive period of Chopin's life. He steadily composed a series of masterpieces, including the Sonata in B minor, the Opus 55 Nocturnes, and the Opus 56 Mazurkas. The growing demand for his new works and his greater understanding of the publishing business also brought increased income and provided Chopin an elegant lifestyle. By the mid-1840s, both Chopin's health and his relationship with George Sand were deteriorating. His behavior had also become erratic, possibly due to an undiagnosed form of epilepsy. Their affair ended in 1848 after, among other things, Sand's unflattering portrayal of their relationship in her 1846 novel, Lucrezia Floriana. At the end, both parties were too proud to reconcile, and Chopin's spirit and health were broken. He made an extended tour to the British Isles, where he struggled under an exhausting schedule, making his last public appearance on November the 16th, 1848. He then returned to Paris, where he died on October the 17th, 1849, at the age of 39. His body was buried at Paris-la-Fresse Cemetery, but his heart was interred at a church in Warsaw, near the place of his birth. And how about some jazz music with a local touch? We have this article written by Josh Schaefer, published in the News and Observer on the 29th of February, 2016. Thelonious Monk needs a statue in Rocky Mount, his hometown, by the railroad. Rocky Mount. In 1917, a gritty corner of Rocky Mount witnessed the birth of Thelonious Monk, perhaps the most eccentric giant of a jazz, a goateed hipster in a skullcap and bamboo-framed shades. On the surface, nothing about this ragged railroad town suggests Monk or his music. Off-kilter, strange, yet effortlessly cool. But if you walk down what remains of Red Row, the alleyway of Monk's birth, you can still hear the clatters and bangs as trains roll by on either side, sounds that filled Monk's head as a boy. Monk's family fled those streets for New York before he turned 5 years old, and the man who composed Round Midnight and Straight No Chaser never returned. But to hear his modern kinfolk tell it, Monk considered himself a Tar Heel first, his rhythms rooted in the Edgecombe County Church that sustained his mother through Jim Crow. And for that reason, they'd like to see Monk's statue along the same railroad, his flat fingers jabbing at the keys of a bronze piano. "He's an American original, and there's a lot of history here," said his cousin Bobby Monk, who was leading the drive to raise $255,000. His mother was from Rocky Mount, and his mother raised him. Hopefully, when people come through on the Amtrak, that statue will be here. Monk took his first steps in sight of the railroad, a citizen of the black neighborhood still known as Around the Y, because it hugs an intersection of the Atlantic Coastline Railroad. In Monk's time, the neighbors were poor, only a generation removed from slavery, trapped in a cruel era that saw the promise of emancipation run down by forced segregation. They also heard the music, wrote Monk biographer Robin D.G. Kelly, whether in church or at a local juke joint or on the railroad or in the voices of street vendors in the early hours. "I'm not sure I can go this far, but I've read critics who hear those train cars and Monk's dissonant chords, which can sound to the unsophisticated ear like he struck a wrong note or let his piano go too long untuned. I've read others who hear the church inside Monk's jangled melodies, who find his compositions to be deeply spiritual, rooted in revivals and psalms. No matter how much North Carolina Monk carried around the world, playing from stages from the Village Vanguard to Japan, he made his way to Raleigh in 1970, playing an astonishing 10 nights at the Frog in Nightgown in Cameron Village. A picture of the ailing jazz lion, then 52, appeared in the News and Observer under the caption, "Star Returns." Writer and documentarian Sam Stevenson wrote an excellent account of that night for Oxford American in 2007, in which he interviewed Bruce Leitner, an attendee and son of America's and Raleigh's first black mayor. And this is a 1958 recording of Thelonious Monk performing Around Midnight. in the background right now. The article skips down and ends with this. The state placed a historic marker near Monk's birthplace in 2012, and a plaque describing Around the Y stands in Thelonious Monk Park on South Washington Street, where I watched tank cars roll past on Friday. But I think a statue would more than enhance Rocky Mount, much as John Coltrane's has done for High Point. So many musical notables started in North Carolina. Coltrane in Hamlet in High Point, Monk in Rocky Mount, Billy Strayhorn in Hillsboro. We don't celebrate them, it seems, in the way that New Orleans does Louis Armstrong, even though Armstrong disowned his hometown for many years over segregation. Maybe it's because these Tar Heel musicians split downtown so quickly. Maybe it's because their music outlived its audience and has grown harder to hear. But I encourage donations to Bobby Monk's Statue Fund to let a new century know about the sharp-dressed luminary who walked the same streets, saw the same scenery, heard the same racket, and turned it all into music. Efforts are underway to place a statue made by sculptor Ed Dwight in Rocky Mount, Thelonious Monk's hometown. To contribute, send donations to the Monk U.S. Memorial Foundation, Post Office Box 1041, Washington, D.C., 20013, and make checks payable to that foundation. And in music research and technology, we have this article written by Belinda Huang, published in sonicbids.com, entitled, What Kind of Impact Does Our Music Really Make on Society? As musicians, we are carriers of influence, whether or not we are aware of it, and whether or not we intend to be. The sound and messages we release through our art form directly impact our listeners in powerful ways. This is especially true of the youth and adolescents of our society, who are still extremely malleable to the world around them. I remember sitting in the car with my two little cousins, ages 5 and 8, when Get Lucky by Daft Punk came on the radio. They both started singing every word at the top of their lungs. And when Katy Perry sang during the Super Bowl halftime show, the kids at the party sang nearly every lyric verbatim, putting me to shame because I didn't know all the lyrics, and I'm an aspiring to be a pop artist. It began to shock me just how acutely youth are being impacted by the music they listen to, and how much attention they're paying to the music being played around them. I believe that those who really love and care about music are the ones who grew up listening to songs that touched them and spoke to them in a profound way. I remember being in middle school when the music I listened to defined so much of my identity. As professional musicians, it's no doubt that so many of us can identify with music being a keen agent in shaping the person we have become over the years. Thus, in return, it's almost our unspoken job to create a sound that will be amplified to the next generation, impacting them and impacting our society in return. If we can gain a more comprehensive awareness of how our art form is making a difference around us, we will undoubtedly become better musicians, musicians with a purpose. The author then goes on in this article to identify at least three impacts, a cultural impact, a moral impact, and an emotional impact, and she describes each of those in detail in that article, and she ends with this. Music has the potential to change a mood, to shift an atmosphere, and to encourage a different behavior. In fact, the average American listens to 4 hours of music each day. Just imagine what kind of an impact music is having on our emotions throughout the day, whether we consciously realize it or not. With emotional impact, the most important thing to consider is, what am I feeling and how do I want my listeners to feel when they hear this song? Because what you're feeling will help determine what your listener will feel, and that carries a lot of weight. So in short, music has the power to culturally, morally, and emotionally influence our society. Thus, the more intentional we become with sounds, messages, and moods we create and release through our music, the more powerful we will become in making deep positive impacts. We have the mandate and authority as artists and musicians to change the world around us because of the influence we carry, and that truly makes music something worth dedicating a life to. Belinda Huang, by the way, the author of this article, is a music production and engineering major at Berklee College of Music. Finally today are two more fun and weird facts about music. Termites will eat wood 2 times faster when listening to heavy metal. And finally, the longest song title is 305 characters, including spaces. Here's the title. The sad but true story of Ray Mingus, the lumberjack of Bulk Rock City, and his never-slacking stride in exploiting the so far undiscovered areas of the intention to bodily intercourse from the opposite species of his kind during intake of all the mental condition that could be derived from fermentation by rednecks. That's the entire article's title for that music song. And finally, we have this last fun and odd fact about music. When Billy Crystal was a child, his babysitter was the legendary Billie Holiday. We've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review, and as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website at triangleredingservice.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.